Hey, Holly.
Hey, Dave.
Welcome to the What Difference Does It Make podcast.
Welcome.
This is exciting. We have Trevor Steele from the Escape Club today.
I'm so excited.
Yeah, we're going to touch on his entire career and learn about his beginnings, amazing middle part of his career.
And there's no end in sight.
And he's going to give us some insight into the making of some of his iconic songs.
We're going to get the goods today.
Yes, let's get right into it. We've got a special guest today. This is exciting.
I'm so excited.
Yes, this is Trevor Steele.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Good to meet you.
He's promoting the 80s, Live 80s.
Yeah, it's Lost 80s Live, it's called, to give it its full title.
Nice. Yeah. But the reason I found out about this is because you've also got a song you're promoting too.
Yeah, yeah. We're promoting a song to go with the tour. So, and it's kind of fun to do both, really. I mean, all the people coming to the gig obviously want to hear Wild Wild West above everything else. Mm-hmm. But we got a song called We Can't Go Wrong. So we got a song that's more current. This 1, 2, 3, this is the fourth album we're on now. So okay. after over 30 years, four albums.
You're like Guns N' Roses, yeah, the way you put out
exactly.
albums.
Wait, fourth album, why do I have five?
Oh, maybe it's five. Hang on. Well, okay, because there's an album called, let me look at your list.
Don't look at the rest of my notes, because there are questions I want to ask you.
1, 2, 3, Cloud 10. Okay, so Cloud 10 was an album, but it wasn't initially an Escape Club album. It was just me and John, the guitarist. Oh. We just called it Cloud 10. Mm-hmm. Then we put it up on, what was it in those days, CD Baby. And for some reason, they kind of caught wind of the fact that we were the Escape Club, and it just became an Escape Club album, which is kind of weird. I never argue with that, but it wasn't officially an Escape Club release, which is kind of weird.
And so, I listened to a song on my way over here from that, and I didn't realize that it was subsequently billed as an Escape Club album.
Yeah,
is what you're saying.
Yeah, and because I'm singing on it, it sounds like the Escape Club, but the style is so different to everything else we've done. Yeah.
Well, that's very cool. Yeah. But this song, I was looking, it seems it was on an album that was like 5 years ago.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, called Celebrity. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, guys, I've had to listen to it this morning to remind myself of the song because it's been around, you know, that we've got all our songs hanging around, and I never listen to them because most artists don't listen to their songs. So I had to listen to it again this morning to remind me. Oh, it's great. I love the song.
That's what we want to hear. That's great.
Why is it coming out again? Or what's the idea behind
this?
Well,
the idea was it from that album, that seems to be the one that gets the most reaction from the people who listen to us. And through the label that we're going through, we thought, well, hey, let's get it out to radio again, just remind people while we're on the tour, because we're doing dates all over the country and we'd rather have something current out there.
Yeah.
Rather than just keep playing the old stuff. So that's why we did it.
Do you get a chance to play it at all on these shows?
Not on these shows. We are lucky to just sort of, some of the shows, we only get to do one song.
Oh, wow.
Which is nuts. We didn't know that before we went on the tour, to be honest. There's a whole load of stuff going on backstage amongst all of us bands going, what? One song? Are you kidding me? You know? Mainly, the main ones we have to do that is we've done three Casinos. And they want them out on the slots quick. They don't want it. They don't want the audience in there listening to songs when they could be spending money.
Mm-hmm. One song?
Well,
I mean, there's so many artists. I mean,
yeah, it's like a review. There's some.
It's like, yeah, Flock of, I mean, it's like the 50s review. Like,
it really
like churning them out. Here they are, Flock of Seagulls. Here they are, Missing Persons.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And to be honest, it's not what we signed up for, really. But then the other gigs, we can go and do four songs, and that's fine. Then we're happy. We're all happy then.
Is there an opportunity for, like, is it like in the old days? You're at the merch table afterwards signing, and then, like, that's getting, signing people up?
All that stuff is very, very old-fashioned in that respect. But for us, it's really good because it's been 30 years since we've been out, really. Mm-hmm. You know, we did some about 7 or 8 years ago, but that wasn't with the full band. And now when we go out, because it's the original members now, it's me, John and Johnny up the front, we're getting such a reaction off of people because they've had all those years to learn to have to live with the song. So I don't have to sing, they're just singing all the words for me for all the songs, you know. Yeah.
It's an amazing thing. I mean, after 30 years, I mean, is it a shock? I mean, you must have been like, I don't know if they remember us or if there's, you know, when you're about to get on the road. What's that like?
Really. Well, I always thought, you kind of think, well, they're going to come and hear Wild Wild West because that was a number one song. People remember it. But then there's a whole load of people who know the band and they know all their songs and they say, why didn't you play this? Why didn't you play that? And that's quite heartening, really, because I'm living over, I've been in Australia for 15 years. I'm back in London now. we're not really in touch with our fans so much, not on a face-to-face, day-to-day level. But when you see them come back after the gigs, you touch their lives, and it's really nice, you know. Yeah.
Well, do you enjoy playing live now as much as you did?
I prefer it now. Because I don't have a record company breathing down my neck. I don't have, you know, I don't have to impress radio stations. You know, I just go out and play to the fans, you know, and it's great. Really good fun.
That's great. Yeah. Because it's this audience that remembers all these things, these events and, you know, what was going on in their lives.
Exactly. And they're there to have fun.
Yeah.
But we've had people come up to us like in tears, you know, say, this reminds me of this and that. And it's like, well, great. You know, that's
it. It's because it was a certain, like, I guess, because it was the area, it was a particular era for us with music, and it really means, you know, probably more to us, like, you know, our parents who grew up in the 50s and 60s, that music means as much to them as this does to us.
Yeah, that's right.
So does it feel like, I mean, back in the, let's go back to when Escape Club was starting. I mean, you're right now you're trying to win. The audience was already there. They know the songs. What was it like in the early 80s in England? What was the club scene like? Were you
starting out?
When we were starting out, I've got really fond memories of that because we released an album called Whitefields on EMI. Mm-hmm. And we used to play to about, I don't know, we got to a point where we were playing to about 500 people a night. And we used to play in an old club called The Marquee in London, which is a well-known club. Yeah, everyone played there. And my fondest memories of being in the band in those days, when you've got really mad, sort of really devoted fans come to hear all the album, you know, jumping up and down, mosh pit, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And we're young and we're enjoying ourselves. But then the way things changed was we had another record. The guy who ran EMI, and this wouldn't happen these days, said, yeah, that Whitefields album, it was okay. You know, you sold a few, not enough for us, really. You guys better write a hit for the next one. Mm-hmm. These days, you wouldn't get that chance. But so we went and we wrote Wild Wild West. That changed everything.
Mm-hmm. Did you know right off as you were writing it?
You kind of do. Yeah. You kind of do. It started off with just a drum machine and, you know, the idea sounded like, oh, that sounds pretty good. But it wasn't until we got in the studio and started making the record. So I think Wild Wild West is like a hit record rather than a hit song. Like if I played it for you on an acoustic, you go, yeah, that's pretty good. But once you've got the whole vibe going on and the rap in the middle and all that sort of stuff, it just turned into this monster. Yeah. By the time we'd finished it, it felt like a hit then. Yeah, it did.
Yeah. The label was happy right away.
No, this is the interesting thing. So we were signed to EMI. There was a big, as happens in corporations, there's a big change. The guy who'd got to do the other album had gone. There was another guy in charge and new head of A&R. And he played it back. We played it back to him and he said, no, I don't hear a hit.
Was this the exact single?
The exact single. He heard Wild Wild West and said, no, it's not a hit. I won't name his name.
Didn't EMI pass on the Beatles? No, it wasn't. No, EMI signed
they
the
signed the Beatles.
They signed the Beatles. It was another label that
but
passed
on. But this guy said, no, it's not a hit. And he really went up high in the music business, and he would not admit it. I've heard through the rumour mill and everything that he doesn't admit to, but I know because I was there. So anyway, so we then went across to Atlantic. We had a really good label management, so they managed to get us off and get us over to Atlantic.
So you were signed to like your standard five album contract at EMI, and you were able
to... Yeah, we had to buy ourselves out, which is a very sorry, sad story, because in the end, we didn't make any money because it was all paying off EMI and paying off this and paying off that. So as far as actually record sales went, we didn't earn a cent.
Did you end up owning your catalog?
No.
No.
No, they've still got it. It's quite a common thing for bands from our era. We don't own the catalogue. We don't earn any money from sales even to this day. Mm. We get publishing. That's the only thing. And that's pretty good. Yeah. But it's not, you know, because I look after bands now. I wouldn't put up with that.
It's not what it should be for
No,
artists.
It's not what it should be. Insane. Yeah.
And that's going to be a constant fight for years to come, I think.
Yeah.
Well, so did you learn something from the first album? I mean, just recording-wise, were you happy with the sound of that album? Or, I mean, Scott Litt produced that.
Yeah.
I don't know, from R.E.M.
Yeah. Scott was brilliant. Scott was, he was an engineer producer, so he was more sitting at the desk getting the sounds. We were obviously very green in those days. At the time, I wasn't necessarily as happy with it as I am now. I look back on the album, it's my favourite album of all
albums.
Is that
right?
Yeah.
Wow.
It is. I prefer the songs, I prefer the vibe, I prefer everything about it. But that's because I'm getting a bit older, maybe. You know, I like that sort of sound. And then we did the next album with Chris Kimsey. I learned more about production from Chris.
Chris did the Stones.
He did the Stones, Duran Duran, Killing Joke, everybody. I mean, yeah. He was a big producer at the time. I think when we worked with Scott was still finding his feet as a producer. He was a great engineer. Mm-hmm. But we were one of the first bands he produced. He'd just done Katrina and the Waves before. He was brilliant. I mean, the guy was really good. But I think Chris got us a bit more. And I think our songs were probably more geared towards radio by that time. And Chris was really good at, especially Wild Wild West, he just pointed it at radio. And he did a really good job of it, you know. Yeah.
That's amazing. So, okay, let me just go back to Wild Wild West.
Yeah.
Who discovered there's the sample, that's the Deep Purple sample.
Oh, no, that's on, no, the Deep Purple sample's on, it's on the Dollars and Sex album, and it's on Call It Poison.
That's right. I'm thinking of,
yeah, that's
so that.
Well, we might as well go to that point. Yeah, anyway, yeah. So that's
sorry.
No, we sampled, it was off Made in Japan, I think, Ian Gillan. It does this really long song. Yeah. Scream. And we were kind of doing this. This was during the big hair era. And we'd, you know, like the whole of Melrose was full of people with hair up here, up, you know, I'm pointing up, you know, and wearing leather pants and all that sort of stuff. So the song was kind of making fun of that whole thing. So we thought we'd take Ian's scream. And we asked if we could use it. And he said, yeah, which was really good of him. Didn't charge for it.
Friends with him?
No, we just applied, you know, just emailed him or phoned up or whatever at the time. Yeah, yeah.
He's like, yeah, go right ahead.
Yeah, that's really cool.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
All right, this is a good time to take a break.
This seems like a great time to take a break.
Okay, this is it's fun with Trevor, and we'll be right back.
We'll be right back with Trevor Steele.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Welcome back to the What Difference Does It Make podcast and our special guest, Trevor Steele.
I kind of wrote down all the, like, the four songs you get to play on the tour.
The four songs we get to, if we can. Yeah, we got four songs to play, yeah.
So, okay, so when we talk about Call of Poison, that was about, was it the LA music scene?
It was pretty much.
Were you living here at the time?
Well, we did our third album. Yeah, that's the third album. So we were doing that in LA. And we wrote that song while we were in LA doing the album. So that's what it's kind of based around, you know. Yeah.
That was also a fun time here.
Yeah,
it was. We had such a ball. We really did.
What were your impressions of the Sunset Strip?
Oh, I loved it at the time. God, you know, I think the thing is, it's a love-hate thing with Los Angeles, that, and especially like young guys coming from London. We came here, wow, this is amazing, you know, and it's just like, just immerse yourself in it. And in those days, it was during the sort of Guns N' Roses thing and all that, and there was hair and tattoos everywhere, you know, and we just loved it, just fell into it, loved it.
I think in that video, aren't you, is that you riding a motorcycle off the...
No, it was somebody else, some extra.
Okay. So you weren't riding a bike. You had the long hair and the leather.
Well, no, I knew enough people who'd met a sticky end on bikes, so I wouldn't touch them. Yeah.
That's funny. Exactly.
Yeah. Where did you record that album?
That album was recorded out in Peter Wolf's studio. Did we do some in Topanga Canyon? There was in one of the canyons. I can't remember what the studio
Canyon
was. It was one of the, it was, what one was it?
Laurel Canyon.
It was Laurel. Yeah, I think it might have been Laurel. Yeah, it was. There was a studio in one of them. And, you know, I can't remember now. So long ago.
So you recorded? Did you what the second album? What the second album was just the Escape Club, right? It was called the Escape Club.
No.
Wait.
First album was called Whitefields. The second album was called Wild Wild West. The third
album was called Wild. Okay,
yeah, it was called Wild Wild West. Yeah.
And where was that recorded at?
That was recorded in Maison Rouge in London with Chris Kimsey. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You have so many roots in London. What can you explain to me why Wild Wild West did not become a hit in the UK?
I can explain now that I'm on the other side of the business, and it was purely because we had a rubbish record label. Because what happened was we were signed to Atlantic for America, who did an amazing job and made it number one, and we were signed to Warner's for the rest of the world, who messed up. And basically in London, they had a terrible promo team. And I remember the stories of they were trying to get them into radio with the song, and they didn't. They just dragged their feet all the way. And then by the time it was number one, it's a very English attitude. Oh, well, if they're number one in America, we don't need to play them.
And that was it. But you played in London. I mean, you had a fan base. Is there? And I mean, I'm sure you
people must have toured taken a lot. Alive.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is that our London fan base, this is the weirdest thing, are still based in the Whitefields album. So even on Facebook now, when I'm saying, oh, we're on tour and we're in Texas or whatever we are, we get a few people from London going, why don't you come back to London and play Whitefields? It's just that it's like two different bands, you know?
Yeah,
it's kind of weird.
And do you do that?
We're planning to do it possibly next year. I mean, we tried to do it when Pledge Music was still up and running. We tried to do a Pledge campaign for it. And it just didn't quite hit the mark. And we was like, oh, I don't know, I don't think we can do it really. But I think we'll do a Kickstarter this time. I think we've learned from the last one. We're probably going to have to charge quite a lot for the tickets, but that's the only way we can do it, you know.
That's not uncommon now, though.
No, just have to. And I think people are more likely to pay it now.
Yes.
You know, yeah.
So what is your take? I mean, would you re-record this album? I mean, you've touched on... Yeah,
re-record it. I'd love to go and play it from beginning to end, just live. Just go and just play it. I'd love to do that. Yeah,
and there's that huge fan base. That's
I wouldn't say it's huge, but I mean, if it was huge, we'd have done it ages ago. But there's enough of a fan base, I think, there to do it. I'd hope there is. You know, yeah.
Can you do? Are there enough B sides or somewhere you can like re-release it like that way, or you know, like remaster it?
We did remaster it. It has been remastered. I mean, we could put it out. I think the best thing we could do is put it out on vinyl. To be honest. We could do that. Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of possibilities now. I mean, what is your take on streaming? How does Escape Club do on streaming? Is that
we do okay. I don't know because I don't see any royalties. All I would say, though, is that my songwriting royalties have probably, since streaming came into play, because I've been a songwriter since, my play royalties have probably gone down about 60%.
Oh, so, wow.
Because you get nothing. You get a million plays on Spotify or something. You get $100 or something, you know.
And I guess that leads you to doing these 80s tours? Is that helps?
Yeah, it does. It does. We did the 80s tour just for the fun of it.
Yeah.
To be honest, I mean, to be really brutally honest, it's not that financially viable for us because there's four of us in the band, but but it's good fun to do, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, get re-energized.
Yeah, but right. you get re-energized, and then you may do
It's like working
do the
out,
shows on your
own. Yeah.
Reworking a muscle.
Exactly. That, to be honest, I think we're better than we ever were. We're really enjoying it. You know, like I said before, there's no pressure. And because, well, for me and John, we've been in the studio ever since we split up. I've got better, and we've both got better. He's a much better guitarist. I'm a better singer, and we're just having fun. And we've got the muscle memory of performing, where we can just go up and do it. And Johnny's loving it because it's the first time he's played in 30 years, the bass player.
Oh, okay. Wow.
So he's loving it, you know. So it's great, and it's great having him there so that the three of us up the front feels right again, you know.
That's always nice when because I would imagine with a lot of these 80s too, I've seen a couple where it's just the lead singer and then some backing band that's never played with this guy before.
And we did that about 7 to 8 years ago. Is me, John, Red the drummer, the new drummer, and a bassist, and the bassist was great. He was a good bass player, but every time I look round, there was this guy who shouldn't be there.
Right. You expect to see your band. Yeah, you want to see your band.
And he was 10 years younger than he should have been as well. You know, yeah.
It is what it is. You do what you can do.
That's right.
All right. So you opened the show with, okay, tell me what the name of this, your show, for the 80s show, as I look down your set list. You always open with?
We open with Shake for the Shake.
Okay. You call it Shake the Shake.
Yeah. And it's Shake the Chic. That's right. You guys, yeah.
You want to know if I say it's Shake the Chic?
Yes.
Yes.
Did you know that at the time?
When I wrote it, because in Europe you say shake. So I thought, it's a nice little twist, you know. It's only when we came here, like, this doesn't quite work. But it's spelt the same.
But it still worked. And, and it's a dance song. It's a political song, but it's dancey. Do you do that a lot? I mean, did you try and do that when you were recording? Like, all right, this is a little political. Let's have people dance to it, or let's hide the fact that it's political.
That's
it could be, and people could dig in.
Yeah,
that's not hiding it; it's just catching it.
Yeah, people who are into lyrics got it a lot of the time, but most people just thought it was party tune. Same applies to Wild West, really. I think the whole idea of that album was to do a dance rock hybrid. Around about the same time In Excess were doing it. Really, it's like that was just the sound of the times. Really, yeah.
It does. Actually, I think, was that the video that looked a lot like an NXS video, or was there? I
can't remember. Okay, there
was time, like, oh, wow, this.
Oh, yeah, I guess it did, actually. Now you mention it. Yeah, it did a little bit. Yeah, because it's like close-up, sort of black and white. It looked like Suicide Blonde.
Yeah.
Now you say that. I've never thought of that, but it did, didn't it?
That's hilarious.
That's also a stylistic thing of the time. Yeah.
For sure.
Well, me and Hutch both had long hair and a sense of, you know, it's like...
That was a damn good look in the 90s.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it worked well.
Yes, it did.
Yes, as Holly will attest.
Yeah.
As we go to Wild Wild West again, how many... deadbeats, 47?
47.
Who are these 47 deadbeats?
I don't know. It just sounded good when I was writing it, yeah.
Okay, so you didn't imagine like some sort of...
I just thought of it in those days in London, there were still squats, you know, and people were just living in houses out in Notting Hill and everything because they were all broken down. And that's the picture in my mind was like 47 people just living in this house, you know.
And it worked.
It sounds
good.
Yeah, exactly. That's crazy. Where were you when you found out Wild West was number one?
I was in a little pub in just outside London, and I was in a bar with my buddies, you know, just local friends. And I phoned up my manager because he said, because we were going through the charts, you know, you phone up and you got the chart position and everything. And I can't remember where we went from. I think we were something like number 8 or something the week before. Mm-hmm. I don't remember exactly. And I phoned him up, because I was phoning him from the pub and I was in the, you know, remember how we did it in those days. But anyway, I was on the phone and he just said, well, here's the news, you're number one. I was like, are you serious? And he's like, yeah. And I just put the phone down, went to the bar and said, we're number one. and they didn't believe it. And they were just saying to the guys behind the bar, hey, this guy's just got the number one in America. Yeah, right. You know, no one believed
it. It's crazy because you were in London where it wasn't getting played That's insane.
It was
insane. But people knew you because you'd been
Not really. Been no, like,
this probably, was his pub. What was the pub name?
It was The Bull in Hornchurch. outside London.
Where's Trevor? Oh, he's always at the pub.
They have your picture up now?
No, it's not even a pub anymore, I think, actually. Yeah.
Man. Well, that's cool.
Yeah.
Where were the rest of the bandmates?
I can't remember.
Everyone was. So you weren't on tour?
No.
You were just
hanging out in a pub.
No, yeah, we weren't doing anything. We were just, you know, I don't know, whatever we did, we were rehearsing and, you know.
So after number one, you start touring the States again or what?
The first thing is they flew us out to New York probably the following week. Mm-hmm. And then it was just, oh. That's what it feels like to be a number one band. Because to come from London where nothing was happening and I was in the pub with my buddies on a plane and you turn up and there's a limo waiting for you and all of a sudden there's 3 million radio stations and stuff and, you know, all that sort of stuff, you know.
People recognizing you wherever you went?
Yeah, I remember. Yeah. It's an old story we always tell, but one of the first things we did, the girl who was looking after us, Cheryl, she said, well, do you want to do something quickly before we start? And we said, oh, we've never been up the Empire State, let's go up there. So we all went up the Empire State and we got recognized up there. You know, it's like, wow, this is nuts. You know, there's all these kids after our autographs and stuff. And it's like, oh, okay. Really
That's
weird.
So cool.
Yeah,
That's
yeah.
Really
it was
cool.
kind of weird.
Rock
yeah.
and roll, guys.
Yeah, exactly.
It worked.
Yeah.
Different times, though, because then you were giving autographs, not having your picture taken at the top of the Empire State Building.
That's
no one's
right.
carrying their camera around.
Yeah,
at the time.
No selfies.
Different
yeah, it was totally. Yeah.
Which
yeah.
makes it even more amazing because, I mean, I guess it was MTV, the video.
Yeah, it was. Well, yeah. we owe a lot to MTV. No yeah. question. They broke us, I think, really. Because that was a nuts video, and it was on heavy rotation. So
yeah what was so yeah with yeah. the arms and what was as I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, it was done with mirrors.
That was it.
Yeah, it was done with mirrors, which pre-technology, you know. So yeah, we had these dancers, like ballet dancers, were kind of stretching across, and it was fair, you know, like fairground mirrors, the curved ones.
Yeah.
So it was like that, and we curved their bodies out.
The concave.
So it was,
yeah.
It was really that's what helped, I think, having a good video.
Okay, since we're talking about that song, I have a question for
Go on.
You. There was a parody of it, Adam West.
Who was there?
You haven't heard it?
Oh, I may have done a long while ago. West as in Batman.
It's called Adam West, and it was by a guy named Wally Wingert, who actually at the time it came out, I happened to work with him years ago.
You?
We were working in the music industry, yeah.
This was the time that the first Batman with Michael Keaton
came
out.
Yeah, yeah,
so,
yeah.
So,
yeah, but in the video, he did a video for it, and he used footage, you know, old Batman footage. Yeah, I was just curious to hear your thoughts on the song, if you heard it.
I just vaguely remember it, to be honest. Yeah. How long ago was it?
89.
It was 89.
No, that's why I can't, you know. It was a long while ago. It sort of rings a bell to me.
Yeah. I wonder, because I thought it was really clever.
Is it on YouTube? It must be, right?
It's on YouTube,
I'll find it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I saw it on YouTube. I just watched it yesterday.
I'll find it. That's clever. What did you think,
Oh, yeah, it was very clever, of course. It was, you know, of the time, 89.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, Adam West. You don't need, as we know from Weird Al, you don't need a clearance to do a parody.
No, that's right. Yeah, you can do whatever you like. Yeah, absolutely.
Usually, Weird Al, I think, famously asks all his artists if he can do
to
it.
To support. And then
Wally just went out and did it, apparently.
Yeah.
It'd be an honor, though, for Weird Al to say, can I do your song? Most people would go, please, you know.
Yeah.
Exactly. I would think so. No, I was curious. I didn't know. I wanted to ask you, but I wondered if maybe you would be, you know, if you would be offended.
Oh, God, no. Oh. No.
Okay, so the follow-up to Wild Wild West, I would imagine this is the song that people come up to you and say, this meant the most to me, and it's I'll be there.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I was looking on the YouTube comments, and it's crushing. Like this is the song people play at funerals now.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's like, and I get people at the gigs, the ones we've just been doing, people coming up in tears, which is, it's very challenging to have to deal with that every night, you know. But yeah, we've touched a lot of people with that song, and it's taken on a life of its own, I think, out on the net. It's just out there, you know. So yeah
it's a brilliant thing. And
the inspiration for it?
Well, we were in LA. We were here making the album, and our manager said, we need a ballad, because that's all that was getting played on radio at the time. It's like, oh man, we don't want to do a ballad, you know. Right. So we came up with some chords. John came up with these. We were thinking of trying to sort of copy the old soul chords, you know, like the really old sort of Stand By Me, so all that sort of vibe. So he came up with the sort of classic chords for it, and we came up with a melody. And they went out up drinking on a tequila frenzy, I think, the rest of the band, but I stayed in, and because that's usually the way I usually stay and do the lyrics. So I stayed and did them, and something hit me. Honestly, I can't remember. I know a friend of ours' wife had died.
Yeah.
And it just, something came to me, and I just wrote them really quickly, and just put them down on the table and went to bed. And John said he came in and I don't know if it's probably grown in the telling, but he said he came in and it was on the table and a shaft of moonlight was lighting it up.
like a halo. It was meant to be
and
recorded.
And he said he read it and went, oh, you know, got a shiver. And said, yeah, that's it.
I shed a few tears when I listened to it again this time.
Yeah,
I do. I'll well up if I start talking about it, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, especially, you know, 30 years later, you know, you've lived life.
I've lived life, and it's been played at relatives' funerals. It'd probably be played at mine. My wife can't listen to it, you know. It's just like, you know, yeah.
That's crazy.
All right. Take a minute.
Yeah. Okay, so the video is... underwater? How is that done? That's a crazy video.
Milan, our drummer at the time, is the hero who saved it because we all freaked under there. We were in a diving tank, really deep. Mm-hmm. It's the only way they could film it. So we had to learn to dive before we did it. And what happened was you had to rely on the divers next to you giving you air, right? And then they played the track while you're under like 12 foot of water miming and trying not to panic because we had weights on to keep us down so we didn't float up.
Oh, my God.
And you can imagine when we looked at the rushes, we looked like we were under 12 foot of water with weights tied around our feet. You know what I mean? It was just like, but Milan was, because he's, you know, he's quite sort of heroic sort of chap. He just did it and he saved it, I think. And then there's a lot of footage of me in a room singing it. That wasn't meant to be there, but they had to put it there because we looked so bad. Yeah. But the girl, Nicola Charles, she turned into a singer afterwards, but she was the model who did it. She was really good as well. So between Milan and her, they saved the video, really, in all honesty.
My palms are sweating just thinking about doing that underwater.
And I get a bit claustrophobic anyway. Yeah. So, and because you can't see because it's all blurry. You're not wearing a diver's mask, so you can't see, you're weighed down and you're relying on this guy over here to keep you alive. It's pretty scary, you know.
Yeah. And whose idea was this?
Yeah, who's the manager?
Video director. No, it's a video. Ralph Zeman, his name was. I mean, it's a genius guy and it was a great idea. And it did really well on MTV. So, you know, but my God, that was scary. Yeah.
God, that's crazy. All right, so we kind of come to the end of Escape Club. What happened? I mean, you had a hit on Dollars and Sex, and
yeah, it was number eight on Billboard. So it was a
and then, hit. Oh, I know that's
yeah. that. It, that well, we know what happened. We just want to know the actual transition. So you ended up moving to Australia.
Oh, eventually, no. Like the so I've touched on it before, but the financial situation was so bad and tenuous that by the time we got to the end of that album. On paper, we still owed money, which is nonsense. Mm-hmm. Of course we didn't. We sold millions of records and somebody made a lot of money out of it. So we were struggling. Musically, we'd kind of, and most bands say this, we'd all gone in different directions. Mm-hmm. I wanted to live in America. At the time, my first wife was American, so I was like, yeah, I want to go there. And it makes more sense to be there. None of the others wanted to go. I think John did. What else? Well, the money was not good. The management weren't really particularly encouraging us to make another record because I think they'd done a deal with the label where they probably got paid off because we had a two album deal and we only did one of them. So I can talk out of experience now because I'm in the business,
right, so right,
and I can look at it and go, yeah, somebody made some money out of that, and they just wanted us to split. And it wasn't a particularly friendly spit, and it's really sad, and it really saddens me. I wish we had the internet then because we could have carried on, carried on. John and I went off to do production because we were offered production. The publisher offered us an advance because, you know, we were the main writers anyway, and we had some songs sitting around. But it wasn't fair on the whole band, and I wish it hadn't gone that way. I really do, but it did. You can't change history. So we went off to do a bit of production for most of the 90s. We produced quite a lot of acts in London.
You worked with some big artists. It seems like a good transition for an artist.
Yeah, it makes, you know, from a career point of view, it makes sense.
Yeah.
It's just sad that the band had to split up for it to happen. Yeah. And I don't think it needed to, but Milan, the drummer, was a bit intransigent, and he wanted to fight us all about it. And I was just like, oh, God, it just got ridiculous, you know. You don't want that in life.
You wouldn't have continued playing or forming another band?
That's again, I was offered it. An A&R guy in New York phoned me up and said, "Well, do you want to go solo?" I guess I should have done. But I didn't.
Necessarily.
I felt a loyalty to the guys, even though we weren't doing anything. I couldn't do that. So I went into production, you know, songwriting. Yeah. Well,
but really some big acts, some big.
But I guess, I mean, fortunately, you accumulate all this knowledge and now you're manager.
Now I develop young. I mean, so from all that, then I went to Australia. Originally to do a record for it was a show called Pop Stars, which was a pre-X Factor thing. So I went down there to do that. I ended up on the panel you're doing the Simon Cowell thing down there.
Were you the bad guy?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, well, I told them they were all out of tune and too fat and stuff like that. What you're supposed to know. But, you know.
You know, I can't watch those shows.
It was a good learning experience. Yeah. And in the end, I made the record with the winner and John was down there. He did that with me. And I fell in love with the country. I absolutely loved it. So we stayed there. I found a young high school band called Short Stack, and they were in a band competition. And I just watched them, and their songs were phenomenal. And no one was seeing it. I was like, guys, not see this. So I signed them, and between us, we made them huge. And they were headlining at the Opera House before we even got a deal for them. They were massive. Wow. We used the internet. And I learned so much through those guys because they were kids about how the net works and how to get an audience and all that sort of stuff. So between us, pretty much me and Sean, the singer, made them huge, really. And the others helped, but it was both of us driving it so hard.
Thanks. So you went to Australia for a Pop Star for this opportunity?
For that, but I'm now an Aussie citizen. And but me and my wife moved back recently, about 3 years ago, back to London.
Oh, is that right?
Bad move. Shouldn't have done that.
It's a different way of life.
Yeah, it is.
It's a little crazy right now. But,
yeah, it is. Unfortunately, when we landed, the year we landed was 2016, wasn't it? That was the year when Bowie died, Trump got in, Brexit happened, everything crashed.
Good timing.
Yeah, really bad because we'd sold up in Oz, brought all our dollars back to London, and then the pound went woof through the floor. So, and it still is, and we're stuck there now. So.
Yeah.
There you go.
But it's still home, right?
But it's still home, and I do love London. I'm a Londoner, always will be. But, it's weird to be in your own country and not being able to get out because you've been stopped by politicians, you know. It's really annoying.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
That's a whole other conversation, which I would love to have.
Really.
Yeah.
Okay, so... So what are you're managing a lot now?
I'm developing. I don't manage. So what I try and do, I've got another young band in London that I've put together with a friend of mine who used to run Sony. He's quite a big cheese in the record industry. So between us, we got these young guys. They're really good. And we're about to go looking for a deal for them and see what we can do. But yeah.
Are you producing too?
Yeah, I don't produce as much as I used to. I think I'm... leave that to the younger folk, really, these days. You know,
do you miss the studio work?
I do go in and out. I mean, I do go there. I don't miss sitting there for, 12 hours a day listening to a kick drum.
Get that snare drum,
yeah,
right?
No, I'm over that, Yeah.
So, okay, can I ask you while we're talking about that? Because I saw the list of some of the artists that you worked with back in the...
Back in the 90s.
Yeah, so including Atomic Kitten, Bahaman, Boyzone. Pretty shaggy.
Big pop bands, Westlife, yeah.
Anybody stand out to you for any particular reason?
I have got so many stories that I can't really talk to you about. But the thing is, when you're dealing with, because we were primarily dealing with kind of put together pop artists, so, and we're working mainly for a company called First Avenue, who are huge in England, and they did a lot of stuff. So you get to learn. It's a different thing. It's not like working with what I'd call real bands. It's not like working with people who come up through the clubs. It's working with somebody who's come out of stage school who can't really hold a tune, but auto-tune was invented, so we had to sit there and tune them up and stuff like that.
Right.
I've had singers come in and sing and then get a lovely lady backing singer to come in afterwards who I can't really name because you used to have to pay her a bit extra. She was so good at mimicking their voices, she could sing the whole song again, and they'd come back the next day and go, "Oh, I sang that well, didn't I?"
Oh, jeez.
So that's a weird.
Didn't happen all the time, but there's a couple of people it did happen to, none of which were that well known, but I still wouldn't like to say.
Yes, understandably.
Yeah.
And we shouldn't know.
No. Yeah.
Well, I think that's anything else you got.
No.
This has been great. I really appreciate it.
Oh, me too. I really enjoy it. Yeah,
it's a lot of fun.
This is so much fun. We're so happy to have you. I'm thrilled to meet you.
Oh, thank you. Me too.
Yeah,
so, okay, after the 80s tour, you got a couple more dates. You're playing the Greek Theater.
We're playing the Greek.
Have you ever played the Greek?
No. I'm looking forward to it.
Have you been there?
Okay. I'm looking. We've played some amazing venues. We played the Mountain Winery in Saratoga. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. It's worth going just to see the venue. So, yeah, we're doing the Greek. Then we're playing in Vegas the following day. And then that's
Short set in Vegas.
I think it'll be half a song.
That's it? Where else have you been before?
We did a week in Texas. We started, the whole tour started on the East Coast, but we started in Detroit. We went through there. Then we went down to Texas for a week. Then we started up in Seattle and worked our way down through Oregon, down through Northern California, down to here. So, yeah.
That's great. So now that you've got the band raring, firing on all cylinders, what do we got now? What's the future?
We want to do more. Absolutely. We're really enjoying it. We're talking, a lot of the bands on the tour, we're all talking about maybe doing some more stuff. I think the Lost 80s guys want us back, so we'll probably do that. There's other stuff out there, you know. We definitely want to come and do some more gigs.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, I was looking on your social media. You're getting pretty good at that.
Oh yeah, we've got a core following of people and stuff. Yeah, so
yeah. So yeah. I guess you've learned from these kids are teaching you.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, they have taught me. Yeah. Definitely.
So you're saying we can expect more Escape Club music?
You certainly can.
That's very exciting.
That's great. Yeah. Well, that's exciting. Well, we'll bring you in next time. You got an album.
Absolutely. Yeah, you will. Definitely.
Okay. Well, okay. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. That was great.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming into What Difference Does It Make?
So that was great. Great fun.
That was super fun.
Thank you so much to Trevor for coming into the studio and talking with us. We loved it. We hope to have you back soon.
Yes, thank you.
And until next week, this is Dave.
This is Holly.
Check you later.
Over and out.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.